This is Ian Collinge, part one of four, interviewed by Chris Alden Lee on the 29th of November 2015. Ian Collinge, part one.
My name's Ian Bruce Collinge, and date of birth is 4248, and the place of birth was Rochdale, although I was brought up in Aberdeen, Scotland.
You don't have a Lancashire accent, do you?
No, I don't think so.
What was your father? What did he do? Was he an educated man?
No. He was a shopkeeper. And he moved to Aberdeen with my mother. My mother originally came from Wick, right in the north of Scotland. And she, when she was six, moved down to Aberdeen by sea.
Really?
And lived there. Yeah, that was the... probably the only means in a fishing boat.
Right.
My grandfather was a cooper, but he went to sea as a deckhand and a trawler most of his life.
So is the sea in your DNA, would you say?
No, I've been seasick.
But nevertheless, was there, if your parents had seafaring interest, does that, did any of that rub off on you, do you feel?
No, I don't think so. Like most things in my life, things happen by accident.
Yes.
Happened rather than were planned. And most of it was very happy happening.
Yeah. What kind of education did he have, Ian?
Poor. I was condemned by the 11 plus, left school at 15, and went to work as a technician in Aberdeen University Soil Science Department.
In which department?
Soil science.
Soil science?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I was... ironically attached to an NERC project, studying upland Scotland, tree growth, soil, all in relation to soils, and did technicians' qualifications in general stuff and then chemistry and then geology.
And was that because that interested you, or was it just an expedient?
No, it interested me. I actually was... there was a thing then called the Youth Employment Service, which, by my recollection, was pretty hopeless. And because I was good at technical things, apparently on paper, I don't really think I am, they thought it'd be a good idea that I went into a shipyard. And I didn't really want to go into a shipyard. And science interested me, so I applied on my own bat to... a couple of departments in the university and got the one in the soil science department.
So had you studied science at school? Was that a key subject for you?
It was part of it, yeah.
But
yeah.
You never thought about going to university?
I was condemned. I left school at 15.
Oh,
I had no option.
Yeah.
So in retrospect, it wasn't a very good education, and I think in some ways I've suffered from it ever since, because I never had a good foundation in education.
You've not done too badly though, have you?
I don't know.
When do you think this place called the Antarctic first came into your consciousness?
Came into my consciousness because a good friend of mine, Bob, who was doing a PhD in the department. I used to work with postgraduate students on this upland project. He had a friend who had wintered in the Antarctic, I think at Deception, a geologist, and told me about him. And coincidentally, Bill Sloman, a name you must have come across from time to time, was doing what was called the milk round, around the universities. And I went to his talk... talked to him after the slideshow and stuff. And he gave me an application form to fill in. There's no job description or anything. He just gave me an application form, which I filled in, and I was called for an interview. It's as simple as that.
And that would be 19...
That was 19... that would have been 1970.
Okay.
And I was called for an interview early in 71.
But you told them you were a biologist.
I wasn't a biologist.
Right.
If anything, I was more of a geologist and a chemist.
Mm.
But at that time, they were recruiting people to be technical support for long-term projects at Cygni. So at that time, they were recruiting a freshwater assistant, as they were called then, a marine assistant, and a terrestrial assistant. And my background fitted the terrestrial assistant best, purely from the technical angle, not from my... I had no biological experience at all. Yeah.
So you were there to support a scientist when you went? Or a group of scientists?
Support, but also help set up long-term monitoring, which was the Sydney Island reference sites.
Come to that in a minute.
Okay.
Can you remember the interview?
Yes, it was at Gillingham Street, and it was Pete Tilbrook, Morris Sumner and Bill Sloan. And a very old-fashioned kind of interview, but actually the detail of the interview I can remember very little about.
Did you have a sense that it was almost just a formality, that you were going to get the job anyway?
No, not at all.
No?
No.
So you had to work hard, did you?
I don't actually recall very much. I think I was probably too mesmerised by the whole thing. And I had no real experience in interviewing. I'd only ever had one job till then. I was 23 then. And I'd been with the Salt Ice Department since I was 15.
What made you want to go south then?
Because it was different, it was interesting, it was a complete contrast to my previous experience, because my previous experience was pretty parochial, really. Mm. So I wanted to see a bit more of the world.
Can you remember the letter arriving, or was it a phone call?
It was a letter, and I suppose just amazement, really, that I'd got it. And it was a complete leap in the dark for me. It really was a very different world.
How do you mean? What was so different about it? The people? I mean, the climate's different, but were the people different as well?
Yes, the whole experience was different. Right from joining at Monkswood, I spent 6 months at Monkswood before going south, so I was able to meet... I shared a flat with three people who had just got back from Sydney, and another guy that I was going to go south with.
Who was that?
Dave Weller, and the people who were just back were Eric Twelves, Owen Darling and Pete Hardy. And they had just returned after 2.5 years south, so I could learn a lot from them. But in a way, that still didn't prepare me for what I saw at all.
Tell me about the trip south.
Trip south. Well, let's go back one.
Okay, yeah,
that's... I got a letter from my what was to be my boss, Pete Tilbrook, lovely bloke, who I asked about accommodation here, Huntingdon, because we were at Monkswood then. And he said, he wrote back to me saying, "Rest assured, your first night with Bass will not be expected to sleep under the stars," which was sort of reassuring. Anyway, there were several of us arrived at Monkswood at that time, and the only place we could find was a pretty ruined caravan at the back of Monkswood, which had a hole in the roof through clearly which I could see the stars.
Tilbrook was fibbing already, was he?
No, he was his best efforts. We did sort ourselves out a place pretty quickly. And Monkswood, Bass in those days, was really quite different to it. Mm.
Can I go back one as well?
Yeah.
What did Mummy think when you told her you were going to go to the Antarctic and maybe some time?
I never asked her, so I don't know.
Oh, okay.
My departure from Aberdeen, I remember very well, because went down for 6 months and then went back to say cheerio. It was kind of hero's farewell, and I had a Mini at that time. So I said cheerio to everybody, got outside, the Mini wouldn't start. So their last vision of me was pushing this Mini down the street to get it to start. So I don't know, but she would have supported whatever I did. There's no question of not supporting it.
So the journey south, was that the beginning of the opening of the eyes?
No, I think Monkswood was the beginning of the opening of the eyes.
Why was that?
Because it was a new world to me. Never lived in England before. Learned an awful lot of Bass through Monkswood, through the people I was sharing a flat with. It was quite an exciting time, really. The Cambridge Conference, which was, in those days, was very different It was held at Scott Polar. We were put up in splendour at Corpus Christi College. I remember my room had a sitting room with a grand piano in it, which was rather grand. So it was really quite unlike what I experienced before. The whole thing was very, very different. So I learned a lot in that time.
And the facilities at Monkswood, how do they compare to those you've been used to at Aberdeen University, I wonder?
The university was a university department, a small one. Monkswood was it was a one step up from a porter cabin at the back of the research station. We were a very different tribe to the rest of the people at Monkswood. So much fun was had by the Bass image. My wife, the lady who became my wife, was advised when she joined. She worked for the Nature Conservancy Council, and this was after I got back from South. But she was advised when she joined NCC that was at Monkswood, have nothing to do with the Bass boys, their trouble. So she thankfully disregarded that. I mean, FIDs have great fun wherever they go.
But I was thinking also the technologically, you move from a laboratory in Aberdeen to a laboratory at Monkswood, and I wonder which of those two was the most advanced, technically.
There wasn't really a laboratory at Monkswood, it was a set of offices. There was labs for the main station, but the... the Bass accommodation there was a set of offices. But then Bass biology was quite separate from Bass botany. Bass botany was then headed by a chap called Stanley Green, who built his empire in Birmingham. Mm. And when I joined, that was the first step towards making Bass biology. Peter Tilbrook was engineering that, and so was Dick Laws, because Dick Laws was then head of Bass biology. So there was a change afoot, and a change to make the science that Bass did much more than just collecting and identifying. So it was a start of developing Bass science.
What did you make of Dick Laws?
I built part of the reference site's work was microclimate equipment, and to house that we had a hut, garden shed, really, modified just outside Dick Law's office. So he had to lean out the window from time to time to ask me to stop making a noise because he wanted to talk on the telephone. He was a distant figure, but very highly respected from the word go. And was, turning Bass biology into a proper science organisation.
A man with vision?
Oh, yes, definitely. Mm. And huge powers of persuasion and authority.
Well, yeah. Who was he having to persuade?
He was having to persuade, Bass to part with the money. Remember then, the administration was separate. The various bits of Bass were spread all over the country. So it's much less of a cohesive organisation than it is now.
He was having to persuade Mr Fuchs, I presume, was he?
Yes, in those days. And over the eras of Bass, there have been different directors, and each director has brought different things to the organisation. And Fuchs was certainly the explorer. He was once described to me as a martinet. I don't know if that's true or not, because I didn't know him really. But he was the old-fashioned explorer, and distinguished, and achieved a huge amount, and brought Bass on in his way. But it was time for another era, and that era was Dick Laws.
So was Dick, in your view, the natural successor, the obvious man?
apparently, and I don't know if this is true, he was astonished to see the list of candidates applying for the directorship when it was up for grabs, and thought, hell, I'd better do this. And, of course, I imagine was head and shoulders above everybody else.
He was astonished at the lack of quality. Is that what you're suggesting?
No, not necessarily. The variety. Hmm. I mean, for example, I believe, and again, I don't know if this is true, that there's an ex-BAS doctor who became a Royal Naval Surgeon who was one of the candidates. So it was a surprise, I think.
So what do you think Dick brought to his role as director in his quite long term of office, wasn't it?
He, over the various eras of BAS, it's been attacked by NERC, by almost every chief executive. So his main role was staving off NERC. BAS could exist quite happily on its own, but that wasn't thought to be necessarily a good thing by many of the chief executives of NERC. His role initially was defensive, and we were then declining until 82. And then, of course, he put in place the ring fencing and so on that there was the defence to NERC in the future, until now, of course.
This was this was the post Falklands money.
Yes, yes, yes,
yeah,
yes.
We haven't got you on the ship yet, Ian. Tell me about the ship. This is fascinating stuff, so it's fine, but tell me about the ship.
Ship.
Were your eyes opened even wider?
Oh, yes. I remember joining in Southampton, first time I'd ever seen the ship.
Which one was it?
Bransfield. It was her second trip. So she was a new ship then. Tom Woodfield was a captain. Chris Elliott was chief officer. And we sailed from Southampton. Jack Donaldson was the King Fid, who was an ex-Stonington man, and he looked a bit witheringly at Bransfield because it was a modern plastic ship. It wasn't like the Biscoe or the Shackleton. I suppose the trip south starts to get people together. And I remember stopping in mid-ocean in the tropics. These days, this wouldn't be contemplated, but we stopped in mid-ocean in the tropics for a swim. So we just jumped off the side of the ship. That in itself was a great experience. Stopped at Montevideo on the way south. Exotic countries to, you know, the country boy who hadn't seen much of the world.
Was it your first time abroad?
Yes. Mm. It was great. Into Stanley. Shipboard life takes a bit of getting used to. It took me a very long time to get used to shipboard life.
How do you mean?
Because if you're a passenger, well, you're not, because we did chipping and painting and various stuff on the way south, but it wasn't arduous, really. So everything becomes very much a routine, very much mealtimes are ritualised, you know, all that sort of stuff. It took me a long time to get used to that, really. Not just that trip, many more after that. Shipboard life was new. And Stanley, of course, was new when I arrived there.
So you were getting to know the guys that were going to be posted south that season. Anybody who stands out in your memory that you respected or got to know well? Or even disrespected?
Not really. I mean, I got to know the people who I'd be wintering with a bit. Don Goddard and Paul Brodie were the two people that... Paul Brodie.
Brodie,
Who, both terrestrial biologists. And Pete Tilbrook and Bill Block joined us at Montevideo, and that was a very new thing then. Mm. So the ship filled up a bit there. But summer seasons for senior people was a new concept, very much a new concept then.
Were you going for a summer, or were you going for
two and a half years?
2.5 years, three winters.
Yes.
Yeah.
Two winters. So we went to Stanley, got kitted out. Bassett, a small empire in Stanley.
How do you mean?
There were several Bass houses, Bass-owned houses, a big warehouse, a workshop. We were kitted out with clothing. All the communications then was channeled through Stanley. All the pay was done through Stanley. So I guess there might well have been 30, 40 people working for Bass in Stanley. It was really quite different to how it is today. So that was, you know, you get your two kit bags and great excitement over that. The kit in those days was very, very different to how it is today.
So what were you given then? What kind of stuff were you... Bearing in mind you later procured the latest technology and clothing for Bass, what kind of stuff were you handed out to in 1971?
Very rough, hairy shirts, woolly pulleys, trousers which didn't quite really fit properly, a variety of boots that you had no idea what they were for. I mean, things you may have heard of, RBLTs, for example. These were rubber bottom, leather topped. Rubber bottom RBLT. These were used for industrial purposes. You had leather boots for field purposes. These were pretty ancient style leather boots. You had mucklucks, which were a mystery to everybody, really. The Cambridge Conference didn't prepare you for any of this, didn't explain it at all. The Cambridge Conference then was all a showcase of the science that went on at Bass. So each of the science sections in Bass put on the little show, I think to show each other, not to show us.
It was more of a competition, perhaps.
I think so. So practically, it could have been more helpful. Mm. And in later years, it was.
The equipment, was this brand new, or was it...
Yes.
It wasn't the stuff the chaps were going out had left behind?
No. There was a clothing store that was run by a chap called Willie May. Willie May was a Falkland Islander, and I think he's still living. And he still collects his pension in cash from the Bass person in Stanley. Because there isn't any other way to do it. This was a... great fun thing. We also did a few trips to offshore. We went to Kidney Island in the Falklands, and we went collecting animals for Bill and Pete in the inflatables from Bransfield as well. So got to see a little bit beyond Stanley. Not very much, but a little bit beyond Stanley.
A bit of the camp.
Mm. Mm. Well, the outlying areas, not so much of the camp. It's very different to then to how it is today.
And then the boat took you on to Cygne, which must have been another eye-opener, I would have thought.
Well, we first went to Bird Island, and Bird Island was then opened for the first time as a summering station. And there was Mike Payne, Pete Prince and Bob Burton left there, but the hut had to be fixed up first. And that was in the best FID traditions, where a small army of builders... small army of people with a few builders went ashore to nail on rubberoid onto the roof and get the place, because it had been abandoned for some years. And that was the beginning of the Bird Island that has developed to how it is today.
So there was an old FIDS hut that was being done up for a new scientific purpose.
Yes.
Was that part of Dick Law's plan?
Yes. Yeah, because he wanted to develop... seal biology and bird biology, and Mike was a central figure of that, Mike Payne, and he went to work on fur seals in the summer at Bird Island and reindeer in the winter, and Pete Prince, who went on to do birds and stuff, you must have come across, as a sideline, did work on, I think, storm petrels and stuff, and birds generally, because that was his thing. And Bob Burton, who had experience at Sydney, was able to contribute to that as well. So it was a good thing to do. Bird Island's just the most amazing place.
How do you mean? Tell me more. Describe it to me as you saw it back in the early 70s.
A huge amount of fur seals, a huge amount of birds. And in the 70s, fur seals were still recovering from their population
collapse.
And now, of course, it's even more spectacular. Huge rookeries of penguins. And this was the first time that I'd seen any of this. Lots of stuff going ashore. I'd never gone ashore with launches and boats and inflatables and all that sort of stuff. Unloading at Bird Island, you're unloading in mid-ocean, so it can be a bit bumpy and wet. And yeah, there are times you just can't work there because it is so exposed. So that was all absolutely new to me. Then we went to...
Were you having any doubts at this point, or was it...?
Not till later. I'll come on to that.
Okay.
then we went on to King Edward Point, and I well remember the Brunsfield coming alongside at the jetty at King Edward Point, looking down to this collection of people thinking, my God, where did they come from? because that was beyond my experience as well. I was to become one of those people, of course. And that was interesting, working cargo there, Shackleton House being quite big and luxurious, really, by FID's standards. Quite a small number of people on base. But I don't remember much of the detail at South Georgia. We then went on to Sydney. And Sydney, there was a great rush to get ashore. That year, well, many of my summers were plagued by, were difficult ice years. It's quite exposed landing stuff at Sydney as well. So all the ship's captains would want to get there and get the cargo off as quickly as possible. But that was done, we were left. And it was at that stage when I first got ashore at Sydney, I thought, ooh, have I done the right thing?
What was putting you off? What was ringing alarm bells for you?
I think just the newness of the experience.
The isolation?
No, not that. No, it was all outside my experience.
There's this feeling, isn't there, that it's going to be 30 months before you leave this place.
I never had that feeling.
Okay.
I never had a feeling of isolation at all.
So what was it that was getting to you, do you think?
Just the newness of everything, and could I hack it?
So it's self-doubt rather than...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. But that was fleeting, really, in the summer. And there's so much to do in the summer, setting up all the sites, learning a lot about what had to be done, getting on with it.
What was the accommodation like? Again, both the domestic accommodation and the laboratory facilities you had.
They had, over the winter, they had rebuilt a lab which was to be the terrestrial lab. The main building at Sydney was a two-storey plastic building, which was originally designed to house telephone exchanges in the UK. So it was modular. It was stuck together with mastic, bolted and stuck together. In many places, there was little insulation, little or no insulation. Aluminium windows that wouldn't seal that well. The bottom story was a set of labs. Top story was living accommodation. That sort of thing these days would just not happen. I remember once brewing up stuff in the middle of the night on night watch and nearly gassing the entire base, for example. not sensible. And there was no real cohesive plan to develop the base, the labs, or anything. And in my second winter, we rebuilt one of the labs, but we did it off our own bat. There was no real plan from what would have then been London to do it. And there was no real person in charge of structures and facilities in the Antarctic. It just happened.
Piecemeal.
Yes. So they needed, and there was in time cohesive plans to.
But were you spotting that the absence of organisation at that point in your time at BITS? Were you aware of it? Was it something that?
No,
it was a harbinger of what you later did. No.
No. What I'm describing now is a perfect science of hindsight. So no, I wasn't concerned about it because this was the norm for me at the time. It worked pretty well.
What kind of duties did you find yourself having to perform?
The microclimate stuff that we installed was electromechanical. I guess it had not been used in such extreme conditions before. So it required a lot of looking at, a lot of setting up, and a lot of looking at to keep it working. There was regular sampling of the sites. There were two reference sites: a wet moss area and a dry moss area.
So you were sampling moss. That was your function.
The animals in it.
Oh right, okay, yes.
Not so much the moss. Yeah. So it was mites and Calembla. And the two people working on that were. Paul Brody looking at the algae and Don Goddard looking at the mites within it. And Bill and Pete had come to work. Bill brought with him what was called a Cartesian diver respirometer, which by today's standards fairly steam age bit of kit, but it was a measure of respiration and of mites. So tiny little, I remember making tiny little vessels, which were the divers, that the mites were put in to measure their breathing rates. So that was the sort of thing that I did. I also had sort of responsibility for the main stores on the station. Each project in those days was separately kitted out. So there wasn't a central store that you could go and get a beaker from if you needed a beaker. You would buy one in the UK or have one sent from the UK. So the result of that was, over the years, quite an amount of scientific bits were left south. So I had to sort them out. See what was useful, what wasn't, and what might serve as a stock. So that was another pretty major part of my role. But that was tended to be a winter job because there was lots to do in the summer and less to do in the winter.
Why were you wintering? I know later on Cygni became a summer-only base, but what was the impetus for having at least some people staying there all year round?
Cygni had then been a wintering base since about 1948-49. And you would want it to be a wintering base for all the science because you would want to carry out, I mean, this is long before the days of logging gear. So you would want to sample, you would want to observe, you would want to work on whatever you're doing through the year. So there's long-term monitoring set up by the marine biologists. Jan Hoogesteger was my counterpart on the marine side, so he would do regular seawater sampling. The only way to do that is to be there through the year. The same with Chris Amos on the freshwater side, the 16 lakes on Cygni. So this is building up a picture of the whole biology through the year. So that's what we were doing.
But you can't have spent 2.5 years just measuring the breathing rates of small animals. You must have had a more varied responsibility than that, I would have thought.
Yeah, because we all helped each other. So if you wanted to go diving, you needed a whole set of people, more than the marine biologists on base, to drive the skidoo, to operate the lines, to do all the and accompany the divers as well. The same if you were going sampling on the reference sites, you would need more than one person. So we operated as teams. So that was the reason. Everybody shared the responsibility.
But you had to turn your hand to everything, a bit like
yes.
a Man Friday,
yes.
as we're talking about Ireland.
Yes, yeah.
What was the morale like? Was it good?
Very good. Both my winters, there were 16 people on base. Winter is the best time because you're less disturbed by ships' visits and great amounts of stores coming ashore, sorting stuff out. So you're able to settle down into more of a routine in the winter than you are in the summer. There are also the base population almost doubled in numbers through the summer, so it was quite crowded. But both my winters were excellent winters. A group of people that not everybody got on very well with each other, but there was no major disputes or problems. So by far the most enjoyable time of the year was the winter.
Was there time for recreation in the winter?
Yeah.
What sort of things?
A lot of photography, a lot of travel, field travel. And I used to look after the darkroom. I had experience in doing photography and stuff before I went south. So I fell out of the darkroom. So you'd inevitably want to rebuild the darkroom, paint it, all that sort of stuff. That gets done. Travel at Cygni is limited. The equipment and the training in those days wasn't as it is today. And that was, it's probably, it's not a criticism of Bass, it was a function of the time, really. So we had some people who had a bit of mountaineering experience, but not great. But the travelling that we did was probably pushing our luck a bit.
How do you mean? Tell me about the dodgy moments. What were you doing?
We did two trips. I did one trip each winter. That was generally the allowance. So I did one trip up the Sunshine Glacier opposite the base at Cygni. The intention was to get across Highstyle, which is right at the head of the Sunshine Glacier. It's a heavily crevassed, quite, well, by Cygni standards, big glacier. And I did this with Mike Richardson, Paul Skilling, the diver, and Dave Weller. We hauled the sledges and all the gear up the face of the glacier, which is, I'm not a mountaineer, never have been. But that was very new to me then. and we manhauled up the Sunshine. I was introduced to crevasses, particularly when I stepped in one. And again, rope techniques and so on, there was no training of that sort. The equipment was what there was on base. There was no general oversight of the stuff that was on base. The temperature, I don't know what the lowest record for Cygni is now, but it was minus 40 and it was on that trip. It was blowing quite a lot and we retreated down the glacier. that was very interesting.
Elaborate on the word interesting.
Well, it could have ended in tears because of inexperience. we took a pyramid tent and a pup tent, which a pup tent for those sorts of conditions is pushing your luck. We were fine. Nobody got hurt. Nobody, it all worked. In my second year, we went down to what's called the Divide, which is right at the end of Coronation Island, on sea ice. And the sea ice had, both my winters, very, very good sea ice. And the sea ice was stable, but of course, if it had gone, we would have been in a pickle. That was manhauling.
You wouldn't be able to get back, you mean, or if it had gone with you on it?
Both. I mean, that happened at Horseshoe. If we were stranded, exactly that happened at Faraday, or Argentine Islands as it was then. you're pushing your luck.
Was there anybody who was saying, don't do it?
There was an approval system then. I think you had, whatever it was, anything absence out of base more than 72 hours, you had to ask permission.
From London?
London. But of course, that would have been Fuchs. Fuchs probably didn't have a lot of experience of Sydney. He may, I mean, sensibly, may well have asked Dick Laws, who'd wintered there. So it's not the properly risk-assessed environment that we now live in. Therefore, the risks were much higher. And, you know, the accidents that happened in the 70s and 80s are testament to that, really, sadly.
Did you at any time in your career south ever fear for your life?
No. There was one time when I was diving without a line that I wondered which way the hole was. This was in ice, under ice. And that was a sobering moment. That was my own fault.
You had no line, no rope.
And that's, you know, you just don't do that. But no, I'd never thought. There's lots of times where you bounce about. Probably the most dangerous time south is if the weather is bad and you're trying to get back to a ship, because you bounce about a lot then. But most people are more aware of risks.
Well, was there any? Did you sit down before any of these expeditions in your time in the early years? Did you ever sit down and say, do a kind of an analysis, not exactly health and safety, but just a prospects analysis, a likelihood analysis of what you should do and what you shouldn't do?
No.
No? You just went for it?
Yep. It was naivety, yeah. Simple as that.
Do you think on reflection that it's surprising how few deaths there were with FIDS over that period, the pre-health and safety era? Or were the blokes always equal to the task?
That's difficult to know. Mm. I would say that some of the accidents, fatal accidents that happened, although I don't know the detail of them, it would be easy to think that it was due to inexperience, lack of training, and possibly lack of supervision. In terms of, you know, no, you shouldn't do that. The world we live in today, much is there's much fun poked at health and safety, but my gosh, it has a role.
Most of the accidents, I think, were down to just coincidence almost, weren't they? It seems to me, or the circumstance, things went wrong beyond the expectations of the parties.
Beyond the expectations, beyond the experience, and beyond the training, possibly.
Okay. This work you were doing then with the scientists, where they were measuring the respiratory rates of small creatures in moss. Did you ever ask them what the point of that was?
No, I think I just accepted it.
Was there an applied point to it, or was it just simply empirical research?
No, I think it was pure research. There were still, I mean, that was still also in the days of finding out what was there in some detail, because detailed research, I mean, things had been collected, things. Roughly what was there was known, mostly. It was taking it to the next stage.
Confirming what was there.
Confirming, but also then looking at specifics.
So did you sense that you were doing cutting-edge new research, that it was important work?
Probably not then. The whole world of South that then for me was ooh ah. And I just accepted it. There was a lot of when we, the three assistants, of which I was one, went south, there was an awful lot of setting up, because these projects lasted for about 10 years. So there was a lot of setting up of routine monitoring. And, of course, it's routine monitoring that becomes important. I mean...
the ozone hole.
Exactly. Yeah. That's the classic example. You know, there's no... Before it was going to be closed down because it was of no possible interest to anybody until somebody noticed that there was a bit
John
of Shanklin, an issue.
Yes.
Yeah.
So apart from the routine that you were, and I appreciate science and Antarctic life is quite routine. Were there magic moments that have stayed with you?
Oh, learning to dive is probably one of them, because the diver in my first year was a chap called Paul Skilling, excellent bloke. And he taught people to dive, and we started to learn to dive in the cove by cutting a swimming pool out of the sea ice. I did quite a lot of diving, helping with the marine programmes, because I enjoyed it so much. Diving in the Antarctic's a real exciting thing to do. Particularly through ice, particularly when the visibility... I mean, it's like diving in the Mediterranean, but just a wee bit colder, because the life is amazing. The visibility is fantastic, and it's great fun.
So what were you finding? Were you finding things that you weren't, that the scientists weren't expecting?
No, again, it was diving. Well, diving then was to support programmes like Mike Richardson's, for example. Mm. And he was looking at what the communities of animals within Weedhall fasts were. So he would go down and collect complete hall fasts. Brian Kellett was looking at nematodes, so you go down and sample nematodes, put out traps and stuff. He actually developed, again, it was amazing for the time, he developed photographic stuff in and made the housings on base to photograph nematodes on the bottom. Nematodes are worms on the bottom.
So he devised an underwater camera?
He did, yeah. And with help from others. But that was the sort of environment that we lived in there. If we wanted to look at something, you just found what you could to answer the problem. I'm thinking of that. Dave Weller made a canoe in second winter, and the length of the canoe was determined by the longest piece of wood that he could find on base. So it wasn't particularly long, so the canoe was called the Portly Lady.
These photographs, were they colour?
We did process colour transparencies. It was long before the days of colour printing. Mm. But the majority were black and white. But most people would process transparencies. But it was easy, but the quality of the water was often not that good. But I did both.
Your 30 months drew to a close, and you carried on doing some scientific work on your way back.
Yes, I had an opportunity to... My replacement came in, and I had an opportunity to... Early, so the handover happened, and I had an opportunity to go and then visit peninsula bases, sampling mainly for Paul Brodie, moss for his algal work. So that was my excuse for going, and I took it. So visited quite a few bases on the peninsula, and that was a real privilege as well. And in my last summer, I was asked if I'd be interested in a job back at Monk's Wood because the vacancy had arisen, and said that I was. So I actually, when I was coming out of base, out of Sydney, I didn't know whether I was going to be flown back, shipped back, or whatever. In fact, I was shipped back. Mm. So I had a vague notion in my mind that I would go commercial diving in the North Sea if I didn't work for Bass. There wasn't a plan to work for Bass. It was, again, circumstance.
So one more question about your first patch, your first period of time. at Signy, and you had talked about being responsible for the kind of the biological equipment store. Which that I get the impression that was fairly haphazard as well. So were you short of stuff? Were you having to invent things? Were you having to
very often have to make things?
Create new equipment to fill a gap?
Yes, but not exotic equipment in those days. And it was the first time that all the equipment of that sort had been drawn together under what was called in those days a store section or an indent, which was just a great list of whatever that indent was in this case.
There was an indent of what was there, yeah. But also an indent of what you needed, I guess. Wasn't it?
Yes, we asked for sort of general stuff each year, and all people coming south would also bring with them what they needed specifically for their project, but there was a backup as well, it was. For a small place like Sydney, it was quite a lot. Of course, it was mainly a biological base. Mm. So,
did you always get what you asked for, or was there sometimes a misunderstanding?
I think there's a great deal of effort gone to by Monk's Wood to get the right things to us. But in those days, the whole business of a commercial packing store being employed. Because that was emerging from the days of when Crown agents used to do all Bass procurement, and that was sort of third-party organisation. So that process was in its infancy, so it did have a few mishaps, like, you know, item 111 beaker, so you get 111 beakers, not item 111. You'd be asking for 10 beakers, but you'd actually get 111 because that was the item number. That sort of thing happened. Yeah.
So you came back to Blighty and Bass offered you a job back again?
I had about 3 weeks off and presented myself to Monk's Wood to start work. And about, I can't remember what it was, 4 or 6 weeks after I was actually working at Monk's Wood, I had my formal board for the job.
After you started?
After I started, yes. And this was complete with a civil service commissioner, which I was in complete awe of. This was Eric Salmon in those days. I'm sure I didn't do well at that, but they didn't kick me out, so I must have performed as they wanted me to.
Was Nigel Bonner on the board as well? Because he became your boss, didn't he?
No, he did. No, it was just a civil service board.
Oh, right.
A formal civil service.
Yeah.
So you become, what was the term? There was a specific term, I can't remember what it is. Certified or whatever it is.
Approved. Installed, whatever they did. So what was your remit? What was your job description, your brief back at Monk's Wood?
I replaced a bloke who was at Monk's Wood when I first joined, and that was just technical support. So I looked after getting together all the equipment that went south and trying to organise a system of resupply for, in those days, Sydney and South Georgia, and I suppose Bird Island as well, although they kind of looked after themselves. But they, in those days, Bird Island was part of South Georgia. It wasn't wintering in those days. So that's what I did until 1980.
So you devised this system yourself? This was the Ian Collinge plan, was it? Or was it something that you had to negotiate? Or
no, it was what I thought was sensible to have on the station to support bioscience.
So the fact you've been there helped?
Yeah, and I went because I had little experience during this period. I had little experience of South Georgia, so I went back south and spent half a summer at South Georgia and half a summer at Sydney, trying to get the whole thing up and running, and did. South Georgia then was a much bigger operation than Sydney Bio. quite a big marine aquarium, labs, and because there were so many buildings then, lots of space, and probably at least equal the number of programmes, if not more.
Mm. Were you just expected to use your initiative, or did you have to pass everything over Dick Law's desk, or was it just a case of getting on with it?
Getting on with it. And that was a great thing. That is the great thing about Bass, or was the great thing about Bass. You just got on with it. Mm. If only NERC had recognised that.
Where would you rather be in that period of time? This is about 6 years, wasn't it? Would you rather be here or south?
I was mostly here. I spent that one summer south, and that was exclusively at South Georgia and Gritviken and King Edward Point and Sydney.
So there was a second summer on board the John Biscoe, or was that the one we're talking about?
No, that was a separate summer, and that was the first. There was a sort of marine offshore programme, biological programme, when I first went south. Gary Maxwell did it, a much smaller scale thing. This was the forerunner of offshore marine biology at Bass. And the Biscoe then was unmodified, so again it was making do, using a derrick instead of a stern gantry, using lots of nets and stuff that had never been used in Bass before. That certainly wasn't my expertise. And the main movers that for that, or the main mover for that, was Inigo Everson. Have you talked to Inigo?
He's due to be talked to.
Was he? That'll be entertaining. He was leading light in this. Martin White, Doug Bone. Doug Bone was, again, a self-taught, started as a technician at Cygni, and absolutely superb on things mechanical, particularly marine things mechanical. Developed a huge amount of stuff. But it was kind of an ad hoc thing, and it was a little bit overmanned. I didn't feel that I had a complete kind of role in that. I helped in everything that I could, but it was finding the way. This would lead to the modification of the John Biscoe, the stern modification, re-engineering, and all the rest of it, and then ultimately James Clark Ross, which was. It is probably one of the best research ships that the UK has had.
So did you have, in a small, modest way, did you have some kind of input into the designs of those ships, or the way that they were?
No, I was another pair of hands.
Hmm?
I was another pair of hands.
Okay.
So I describe myself as a deckhand, and that would be a pretty accurate description.
How do you think the whole system you were working on, the science store system, how do you think it evolved over those 6 years? Was it a revolution or an evolution or a complete transformation?
It was an evolution, and it made better use of resources, better use of
economically, money. You mean?
Yeah. It was like most of what I've done. It was a little cog in a big machine, but it got done.
What sort of advances were you aware of in that period of time?
In what sense?
Well, in the way you were organising the scientific backup for people who were working south.
Kind of drawing it together, because we then came together in Cambridge.
The new HQ,
yeah.
In Madingley.
Yeah.
That was 76, was that right?
75, 76. 76,
yes. Right. In the middle of your... on your watch.
Yes. Mm. So quite a lot was happening there as well. The planning for that was done when I was south, so I wasn't involved in the actual move. John Croxall looked after that, who had just joined then. There was quite a lot happening within the building in Cambridge that needed to be helped along, because that was a huge... I mean, that was a revolution in Bass history, really. All the tribes coming together. And that was a very good thing. So then botany and biology merged and became one.
Was that a good idea?
Oh, yes.
Because?
Because there was there were, and there were for some years to come, actually, people would fight for their empires rather than work collectively. That's probably all. That can be a healthy thing, but maybe not always. So, for example, when the James Clark Ross came along, apparently there was a certain time given to geophysics and a certain time given to biology. Well, you know, perhaps you should have seen what the overall need was and then allocate resources appropriately rather than rigidly pigeonhole things.
So there was a kind of a growing democracy.
Yes.
In the system, shall we say.
Yes, 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 yes. I mean, when you consider that that BAS was widely spread, I mean, administration in London, Ionis Rex in Slough, Met in Edinburgh, glaciology in Cambridge, biology at Oxford, and botany in Birmingham. It doesn't make for a very cohesive organisation, does it?
Tell me about Nigel Bonner. How did you get on with him?
He was very good. He was old school. He came from the Sea Mammal Research Unit to BAS. He had a lot of experience on South George as a sealing inspector, knew an awful lot. I've had a guided tour from him on the whaling stations at Grytviken, knew an awful lot about that. Was a font of knowledge, a very different guy to Dick Laws, but a very nice guy. Not, I think perhaps he wasn't universally liked, but that's life.
Were you happy at Monkswood, or was it always that itching to be south? Well, Monkswood and then Bass. Were you happy in Britain? Back at base?
I wasn't itching to get south again, but I did enjoy going south. So I was very lucky over the years in the amount of the Antarctic that I saw. People used to say I had a good war. I would say I had a very good Antarctic. Mm. So I wouldn't have swapped it for anything. There were good days and bad days, as there always will be. But the good days outnumbered the bad days south. And I didn't mind working back here either.
There was a bit of a change of direction in 1980, and we'll come to that in just a moment.